sometimes things don't go as we plan. Our Zen practice is something that can that needs to be able to adapt to the situation. Tonight I actually want to talk about the roles of great faith, of great doubt, and of effort. I also want to talk about the there's an ancient Chinese very famous piece of writing called The Lancet of Zazen, or the Acupuncture Needle of Zazen. I think tonight I might also talk about the pneumatic toy rocket of Zazen, which I think we can all agree is at least as weighty as a lancet. So Zazen, this practice requires effort, and it actually requires both faith and doubt. And those, all of those parts are not dispensable and actually not avoidable. We might wish for a Zazen that didn't require doubt, but I think few of us ever would encounter such a thing, and I think it's of limited utility. So here's the image of the pneumatic rocket of Zazen. Right, so those are those toy rockets that you like. You put on a little pad, you set these little clamps, and then you pump this thing up a bunch and down a bunch of times, and then it builds up enough pressure that it takes off. One of the things I like about this image is that it then falls back down to earth. So what are all of those parts? So this in the beginning of Zazen, we use breath counting. We use the focus on the breath to kind of build a scaffolding, to build a little platform. And as we move into practice, we never dispose of breath practice. We do often move away from breath counting, although. Even people who are doing other practices return regularly to breath counting. But breath counting is kind of like a scaffolding. It's the stuff that you when you're doing construction on a building that goes up around the outside so that the workers can get in there and work on the structure. And that structure is the body of Zazen. So. We've got to put effort into this system, and then also crucial is the little clips that hold it in place. So those on the toy rocket. So what are those clips? Those clips are the structures. They're the stillness in each period of Zazen. They're the schedule on retreat, where we have to show up for period after period, even of Zazen, even when we. Would really rather be anywhere else in the world. It's the discipline of encountering koans and working with them, even though we're sure we're doing it wrong, even though we're sure we haven't gotten a clear explanation of what it is we're supposed to be doing, and even though we completely doubt them as a method. And interestingly, if we take up the practice of just sitting, of Shikin Taza, we also are pretty certain we're doing that wrong, too, and that we didn't get the full explanation of what we're actually doing. And that energy is important. So I wanted to read you this a little bit from a book called Novice to Master, and the subtitle, which in retrospect should have been the title, is an ongoing lesson in the extent of my own stupidity. This is written, and the first sentence of this book is that I'd have to say, if I were to look back and just describe the 40 years since I became a monk, that I would have to describe it as an ongoing lesson in the extent of my own stupidity. And this is from a preeminent Rinzai master, master in the koan tradition of Japanese Zen. And he says, he's talking about the incomprehensible words of Zen. Form is emptiness, emptiness is form. Or the koans that we encounter that we have no idea what this language means. Any of the kind of language, the kind of words that we can't wrap our minds around. And he says that the practice involves accepting that the words have another deeper meaning, yet not knowing what that meaning is, the student finds himself or herself assailed by a great doubt. Driven by this doubt, spurred on by the constant sense of a problem, they proceed desperately with concentrated practice. This, in Zen, is to believe. I like how the thing we believe in is the doubt. There's nothing that you have to buy into in Zen. The doubt itself can take you all the way there. Can provide that crucial energy into the system, but you have to allow the forms to hold you. And the other things that can be the forms are really taking up, for instance, a diligent practice of study. A lot of my own Dharma practice has been in the context of really reading and being with Dharma books. Assailed by a great doubt, this in Zen is to believe. And so what's the practice of effort with that belief, with that great doubt? He says, Sokomo Naga says, to take the unsettled self in hand under whatever conditions and return to the mind with which one sets out, to pick oneself up again after the mind changes, weakens, breaks down, and stiffens, to carry through the oft-reconstructed originals that bow. And then he says, isn't this the meaning of courage? To encounter this moment of our life, even again and again and again, that is courage. That is the great effort that goes along with that goes along with this practice of believing in doubt, or the great faith of great doubt. With our little toy rocket, if we do this long enough, eventually the pressure builds up long enough, and the rocket takes off. Maybe that is some significant insight. In our tradition, in Bhana's way, we don't emphasize those insights as heavily as certain other schools do. Part of what the value of them is not what you realize, but that it starts to change your perspective of the stuff on the ground. Our great period of meditation and clarity ends, our insight passes, we get confused again, we get entrapped in our own reactivity again, we get depressed again, we find ourselves in our life again. The rocket falls down to the ground. And then this is the practice of courage that's called for there. The other perspective of Zazen, the other tool that we use, and so we move, we in the beginning we start with breath counting, then we have a kind of more formless practice of just following the breath. Then we may move to the tools of koans to cultivate and provoke this kind of great doubt, to require of you the belief in the doubt, to really kind of clamp you face to face with that. Or we might move to the really radical non-doing of not a practice zazen, the not a technique zazen of shikantaza. It's also the case that if we're following on that, that our that somewhere our koan practice starts to meld into that not a technique style, and the doubt starts to transform into faith, but it's not faith that we might wish it is. It isn't the faith of certainty. It isn't the faith of really knowing for sure. It's the faith of being able to trustingly be present to the confusion, to not knowing, to whatever it is that we find ourselves kind of encountering in our nada technique zazen. And so from that tradition, I wanted to read you a little bit from this book. This is called Keep Me in Your Heart a While, The Haunting Zen of Daimon Katagiri. Katagiri Roshi was one of the people who brought who was a early kind of pioneer of Zen in America. And he comes from the Soto tradition, the Zen tradition that only practices shikantaza and emphasizes the writings of Dogen, as the kind of canonical stuff. And this book is written by somebody who was a longtime student of Daimon Katagiri. And each chapter in this book starts with a kind of koan-esque thing, a retelling of an encounter with Katagiri Roshi. And this one in the chapter on not using zazen, the opening poem is this, or the opening vignette. A student said, "Sometimes when I'm angry, I'll go and sit zazen. It helps me calm down and process what I'm angry about." Katagiri Roshi looked down at the floor and grumbled, "Don't use zazen in my head." One of the things I like about this is that Katagiri Roshi looked down at the floor and grumbled. He didn't just say it in vast, expansive enlightenment, but the sense of his person kind of comes through there. I'm going to say a little bit more about that. So what's the alternative? What's the alternative to using your zazen for some means, using it to address something? And we all kind of come to zazen with this kind of impulse, and we think that Zen practice is somehow like a treatment, you know, like something that can treat the problem with us, or with our life, or with our state of mind, and it isn't. Can change your relationship to those things, but using it to fix something, like to replace the anger with a feeling of just I'm so happy and everything is calm and lovely, that is using zazen as a means, and the problem, as I've said a number of times, isn't that it doesn't work at all, because if it didn't work at all, you would say, okay, well, this is clearly just totally failing and I can give it up. But it's that it works a little bit sometimes. And some of my background, I used to work as a behavior therapist for kids with major learning disabilities, and also for adults with brain injuries, which kind of makes them a lot like kids with major learning disabilities. And in that kind of behavioristic paradigm, it's a a random reinforcement schedule is the one that's hardest to extinguish. So something that is reinforced some of the time, that makes for a very lasting behavior. And it's hard to make that behavior go away. Whereas if it's never reinforced, it can go away pretty quickly. And so the problem with using Zazen as a treatment is that it works a little bit sometimes. And so then we think that if only we had more of that, if only we could do more of that all of the time, then that would work out for us. And so it becomes very hard for us to kind of give up that unspoken hope that somehow our Zazen is going to fix us, fix our life, change everything into other than it is. So the alternative, Katagiri Roshi says, I emphasize that Zazen is a koan we have to digest in our whole life. Zazen is not the simple issue you have thought, the means to discover peace. When using Zazen as a means, you never have the great opportunity to digest Zazen exactly in your life. And ultimately, that's also the way we work with poems, is digesting them exactly in our life. And as the Zazen as not a technique, Shikantaza, is really being present to our impulse to fix, to change, to control, our fearful reaction to retreat into something we're sure about, some practice to retreat back to the practice of scaffolding, or to some kind of certainty. And we'll take any kind of certainty. Any kind of certainty is better than just being present to the whole kind of unknowable things as they are. And so we'll even take the certainty that obviously we suck and we failed and we can't possibly do this and this can't possibly be it. And we prefer that certainty to the kind of spacious unknown of digesting Zazen as our entire life. And the other great thing about digesting it as our entire life is that it's not just this thing we do on the cushion. It's the way it's something that we need to bring into each moment of our life. And it doesn't mean that we start moving around like Zen zombies, doing everything in what we imagine is a super mindful, ultra present fashion, and that's another kind of misunderstanding of Zen, and that's another retreat into certainty, retreat that being mindful is this and it's good, and then beyond that, being slow is being mindful, and so if I'm doing it really slow, that must be good. One thing that I noticed for me in with regard to this digesting Zazen as your entire life and my own practice of the radical non-doing that is Shikantaza is that when I sit Zazen and take up this practice, it becomes apparent to me how much I was doing before, you know, how much I was really caught in the story of, oh my God, my life is so terrible, I have so many problems, I gotta do this and I gotta do that, and there's no way around this, and then when I sit Zazen, I start to see how much energy I was putting into creating that, you know, how much I was taking up the practice, the doing practice of suffering, and then just by noticing that, that is a act of digestion. That's kind of, oh, 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 oh. So, referring to this one article, he says, to carry through the awfully constructed original vow, isn't this the meaning of courage? And that vow is that it's the Bodhisattva vows. It's and it's whatever. Yeah, I'm gonna leave it at that. So that's my little scattershot talk on these topics, and I want to encourage folks to courageously and unknowingly dive in with comments, questions, observations, and to remember that this practice of opening your mouth and you know, revealing your liver, you know, opening your mouth and being completely exposed is a practice of generosity. It's a practice of service. And you know, another thing that Katagiri Roshi said somewhere, or it's a title of one of his other books, is "You've Got to Say Something," which is the practice that that any of us who are in positions of leadership and called upon on a regular basis to give talks, you know, you have to say something, but there's not an ultimate truth that we can really grab onto and give it. And so all of us are making mistakes and revealing our foolishness every time we open our mouth to talk about them. And it turns out that actually is it and is really important. So I want to encourage all of you to dive in.
So I was thinking when you started talking about how the whole catastrophe is a mistake and the rocket. And the whole story about when they started doing the rockets, no one could get them to come down exactly what they wanted to, all through the 40s until the mid-60s, the student comes along and says, yeah, well, the booster's hitting it. Because you had the multi-stage rocket and they drop off the boosters. The booster still had fuel in it and was coming up and banging the rocket at some random angle. It just took like someone to not be certain that the booster was dropping away. To do that, I thought that was kind of, I don't know how that feeds into that story, but it seems related to me that, you know, someone can look at it from the outside and see the certainty that it's so delusional. And I wonder how many of those I have.
Right. And you know, and if you found out the answer was 47, what would you do with that? You know, so just so even to retreat into the certainty of how deluded we are is still being certain of that.
Thank you.
then I put them in holes in the top, and put it into the pot, and
so this is a doubt that's kind of it isn't just an intellectual doubt. It's kind of one category below that. And you know what what I heard that was that was kind of interesting is that it kind of in the middle of that you said that when you consider that those things might not be true, you get a kind of fear. And there's lots of ways that we live our life and use our mind as a defense against fear. And so the place of exploration is to be in that, to kind of remain in that space at that edge, at that cliff, without recoiling back, but just to be there and notice that fear arising without trying to fix it or change it or replace it with something else. But you don't need to manufacture that. And it isn't just an intellectual practice. And it's something that comes up in relation to really this great doubt that we're talking about. Comes up not it has to do with like the clips that hold that model rocket in place before it takes off. And you really have to use those tools. You have to use the tools of practice. You have to use the tools of retreats. You have to use the tools of one of the great kind of teaching tools of Zen is interviews, doksan, going to see the teacher and encountering your reactions to that and your reactivity and your kind of resistance and all of those things and being present to that and really taking up this practice of Zen. So that's the context in which the great doubt functions. If you're not doing that, then I wouldn't recommend trying to go through your life trying to manufacture doubt, but instead to notice that edge of fear where you retreat into certainty. Thank you. Thank you. And perfectly expressed. Thank you. And that's the functioning of great doubt. That's the liberating great doubt.
No, I don't really relate to that. Some of the questions you have about the kind of meditating. Understand the anger and whatnot. And one time at school, I can't remember the exact instance, I was really upset, I got something bad grade or got some blood in me or something. And yeah, I really remember the experience of using meditation as a medication. Yeah. And yeah, it did kind of work. You're right. So maybe that was part of an attraction for a couple of years. And, but more recently, one last couple of years now, my practice is more frequent. I mean, and just being more present to the stuff that happens. And just, you know, meditating no matter what, and just being present to whatever's going on, whether it's physical or mental, it seems to work better. It's kind of harder in a way. I'm driving here tonight, and why am I coming here again? But, I don't know.
I also had that thought.
But it's good.
Thank you, that's good. Thank you. Yeah, and there's a way that it's really true that it is harder to just be present to things as they are, as opposed to trying to fix them or change them. But you know, another interesting perspective on that, and that's one side, and that's totally true. And this is a effortful practice. Somebody once said, I think I've shared this quote a few times in here. Somebody once said to John Tarrant, "I'm too lazy to practice those things." And John Tarrant said, "Well, maybe you're not lazy enough." and that also, I mean, and for me, the way that came up tonight was to sit on my cushion and you know, and then to notice how much effort I was putting into having a hard time. What you do?
Yes, I think that's it. And the other one was a reading of the Pebble Children book, and they both talked about observing the behavior. And then by doing so, you can see the storylines of the book, so that if you have fear about it, you can see what yourself and other people put in place to deal with those things. And once you start having this observer experience, it's very fascinating to see all the storylines that people think about, whether it's yourself or another person. A lot of people put a lot of storylines in place that are very important to them.
Mm-hmm.
So it's fascinating.
Well, and not just those people over there.
Oh, no. It's everybody.
Point a finger. You know, you're really telling a lot of stories.
Rosetta,
yeah.
Yes, that you need to observe yourself. That was the book about precepts. And the very old book, every single one of them starts out by observing yourself.
Yeah. And so Dogen, the founder of Soto Zen, says, and when you do the gatha from the Genja Koan, it says to study the Buddha way is to study the self.
Mm.
And then Dogen goes on to say, and to study the self is to forget the self. And part of what that means is that at some point, the studying the self kind of enables us to not be so caught in our own stories, including the story of self.
Yeah, I had a similar experience. I used to meditate as a child to fix our planet. That was the point of meditation. It was going to fix our... It didn't. But I did notice what Josh was talking about, even as a kid. I could sometimes get some benefits from it. I could feel peaceful or get some benefits some of the time. So it wouldn't fix the big problem. I'd go anyway. Then I'd come back to it because it would sometimes work. But then it wouldn't really work a long time and I'd go away from it. And I kept doing that until I found a group and it got me over the part where it didn't work. But so that's interesting.
One of the things that James Ford, one of the guiding teachers of Bhanaswarism, says is that part of this confusion comes from the fact that meditation is kind of refers to so many things that it doesn't refer to anything, and so we are and James calls it a junk word, and so in an important way, what we do in Zen is not meditation. We do zazen. Zazen is something very specific, even if it's something very specific and frustratingly formless, and if only I could get more details on that non-specific thing. But it is a very specific thing that is not the same as meditation. It's not even the same as meditation as it's used in other lineages of and other ways of talking within the Buddhist tradition. So I want to encourage all of you here, when you're on the cushion, please do not do any meditation at all. Where is it for you?
Well, one of my certainties was that I have no faith. And I didn't want anything to have to do with faith. But it kind of harkens back to my cross and upbringing. Just have faith, right?
Right. It's
certainty that there was no way I had faith, there was no way I wanted to have faith, and I thought faith was total bullshit. So I got that. So now we're talking about faith.
Right, but remember that the definition of, the definition of faith is driven by this doubt, spurred on by a constant sense of problem to proceed with practice. This in Zen is to believe. So it isn't that there's some other thing you need to. It's the doubt, and that faith, the faith in things that people tell you to believe in. That's not the same thing as the great faith. In the same way that intellectual doubt, like doubting, well, is that really the truth, is not. Is not the same as this great doubt. I think there's a way in which your life and your practice of Zazen and your practice of chanting and bookkeeping, all of those do express a kind of faith that isn't the faith that you thought it should be or thought it shouldn't be. There's something that brings you out on a Tuesday night, but something that brings you to the cushion. There's something that brings you to a retreat, especially a second retreat. I hear the faith in your voice.
I think it's both Josh and James have said to me, well, you're still here. Oh, sure, go ahead, throw that in my face.
I think the faith in Buddhism is different, because the faith in many Christian religions is, okay, Josh is the priest, so Josh is going to tell us what's true and what happened, and we're going to believe him because he's the priest.
Yeah, boy, would you be in trouble.
But that's the structure that is set up.
Right, and that's not what we're
talking
about.
Not faith. It's that structure where one person is put up here as having the truth that I should believe in for some reason with no experiential validation on my part. Whereas in Buddhism, or at least our Zen tradition, we're encouraged to have our own experiential faith in verification for everything.
And that kind of faith goes hand in hand with questioning everything. the ways that I understand what Mary Lou is pointing out, that that kind of faith comes from the influence that Shin Buddhism has had on me. And there's a way in which what my faith is in a really liberating and heart-opening way, is it's a faith that there is absolutely nothing I can do to fix any of this. There is nothing I can do about this whole catastrophe. And that there's a way in which that is opening, and that's what in different languages I think. Talks about what?
Sanzen,
which is the word that is another word for Dokusan.
If I was reading that paragraph, it was talking about it interpreting as like a submission, a radical submission to Sanzen. What came up for me around that was the submission that to what is in this moment, which is that great moment,
mm-hmm.
how easy it is for us to build constructs to protect us from that moment. For me, this week it's been trust, not trusting, building my book, not trust constructs. I have this in my head. I'm constantly coming back to that moment.
Mm-hmm.
That you don't know.
That's right. And so as we so often see in with so many things, does I in great faith, great doubt, not true. Being free and being totally stuck. Thank you, everybody. And let's go back to our cushions and do the four vows.